You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. This is Commander Tom Garcia. Welcome to the American Hour. And, of course, our lovely co-host, Paula Luzon, is joining us tonight live from Boston, Massachusetts. Paula, how are you tonight?
Doing great, Tom. It's a clear 77 here in Boston, and it feels like it's 79. It's a beautiful day today.
Excellent. Wow. Well, you know, this is getting to be the time of year that's the best time of year in New England. So very, very good. Well, we got a lot of stuff to talk about today, but we'll get rid of some administrative things first off the bat, not get rid of, but cover some administrative things. One of my neighbors has started a website, blogging and some other things there and information. The name of the website, and I'd like everybody to please check it out, is called patrioticjew.com. patrioticjew.com, put together by Ron Morgenstern, and one of my neighbors right here, in just around the corner from my street. His dad is a retired Jersey cop, did an entire career as a police officer in Jersey. He actually works for the Lake Worth Police Department here now, in not the same capacity he did when he was a police officer, but was more as a support staff kind of a person. But in any case, and he has on his business card, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. What he's doing is blogging and writing articles, conservative articles, and the kind of stuff that we do here as a radio host, Paula. He's doing online, and he's getting a lot of attention. So check this out. It's a pretty cool website. Well done.
Mm-hmm.
Is a true conservative and patriot, that's for sure. So patrioticjew.com. So there's there's one of our South Florida Jewish folks that is not a Democrat. It's hard to find him sometimes.
He's gone to the dark side.
Yeah, yeah. So the other thing that's, you know, kind of in the news here lately, we've got I thought it was really nice watching David Axelrod try to hold a press conference. I can't remember what state it was today, but it was all over the news. And the Romney supporters there trying to shout him down and drown him out, and them getting a little taste of their own medicine back. Remember the Acorn days when they used to try to do that to candidates and officials, elected officials, et cetera. So I think we're going to see more of that as the campaign goes on. And good for them. Good for them. Then we've
That was here in Boston, wasn't it?
It may have been. I wasn't sure if it was.
The State House.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it was in front of a state house, so okay, Boston, excellent. Well, good job, Romney supporters. And, of course, you know, when it comes to Massachusetts, he's got a lot of support there since he was governor. Now, what they're trying to portray him is as a failing governor because his state was ranked 47th among all the states economically. But now, do you remember, Paula, what the state was ranked before he took over as governor? Might have been ranked 49th. So he went up a couple notches. You want to compare it to this president? This president has presided over the only downgrade of our financial value as a country ever in the history of our country. He's presided over that. Second of all, Romney did lower the unemployment rate while he was there. So the state might not have been in a great economic position, but that's what the libtards do. They like to ignore the overall facts. And the fact is, he as governor lowered unemployment. This president has raised unemployment. It was much lower when he took over, and it peaked out at 10%, and it's barely crept down to over 8%.
When Romney left office, it was 4.3%.
Yeah, and that's about as good as any unemployment ever gets. I mean, there are always going to be unemployed people. You know, if you're down in the low 4% range, that's as good as we ever get. As good as we ever get.
Definitely.
So anyway, that was sort of in the news, but the libtard of the day has got to be Mayor Bloomberg from New York City. He is threatening to outlaw, like, I don't know how he has the authority to, just because he's mayor. I think he still needs...
the supersized sugar drinks.
Yeah, nothing 16 ounce or greater, I guess. And Paula, this is kind of basic math. If I go to the 7-Eleven or even a restaurant and I want 16 ounces of non-diet soda, whether it be Coke, Pepsi, root beer, orange soda, whatever it is they have, all I have to do is order 2 8-ounce glasses, 2 8-ounce servings. And right now I'm telling people, if you like big gulps, save your big gulp container so that you – or go across the border to Hampshire and get a big gulp container or buy your big gulps over there. But save it. And then when you go into a 7-Eleven, all you have to do is order a couple sodas or purchase a couple sodas and then pour it into your big gulp and you got yourself a big gulp.
Unbelievable. All sick obesity and nutrition, right?
Yeah,
That I'm against it, but I mean, you know – seriously, there's more important things to deal with than that, I feel.
Oh, my gosh, much more important. Look at all the people that have been flooding out of the state, all the wealthier people that they're losing that tax base, that tax revenue. And you know what he said, and this goes to show you his mentality and why people are leaving the state. It was brought up that, this is going to hurt some of our, restaurant establishments and other places that sell soft drinks. And you know what his response was? His response was, well, all they have to do is just raise the prices of their smaller drinks. And that's going to help business. Oh, gosh. You've got to be kidding me. This guy is supposed to be some kind of financial genius? He's a moron, absolute moron. I think people need to do some YouTube videos there in New York.
Yeah.
Pouring two or three sodas, separate sodas, into a big gulp and going like, thanks, Mayor, and then drink it. Good, 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 what an idiot. So he gets libtard of the day, and that could really quite honestly be him on any given day, libtard of the day, but this in particular we're going to give it to him. So let's see, what else have we? Oh, a couple good news things. I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. for a few days in July, around the 10th, 11th, 12th time frame, and I'll get the specific dates out there, but doing some lobbying on behalf of Keystone Pipeline. And
there you go.
What they have done, one particular organization, and I'll get some more details out here, but has done is ask veterans to go to Washington and talk with various groups, including congressmen and senators, about how energy security equates to national security. And I was in the Gulf, the Iranian ocean, or the Indian, not Iranian, but Iran was right there, the Indian Ocean in the 87-88 time frame when Operation Ernest Will and a couple operations were going on. That was when the Iranians were mining the Persian Gulf like they recently threatened to do. What people forget is we shut them down. But at what expense? We weren't originally supposed to go there and spend our entire cruise operating in the Straits of Hormuz and the North Indian Ocean. So we were diverted from our original tasking, and that's what happens. Hey, that's why we're flexible in the Navy and all that kind of stuff. But I can tell you we spent a lot more money with all the operations we engaged in, and we came close to going in, very, very close to going in and bombing one of their military bases. All this is very risky business. It puts our troops, our airmen, in harm's way that they don't have to be in if we were energy independent. And why were the Iranians mining the Persian Gulf? Well, they were pissed off at the Kuwaitis, and they were trying to stop their tankers from getting out of the Persian Gulf. So we had to go reflag the Kuwaiti tankers as U.S. flag tankers so that if the Iranians wanted to attack a U.S. tanker, they were attacking the U.S. And we had to go take our minesweepers out there. Getting a minesweeper all the way over the Persian Gulf is a mighty duty. Well, I wouldn't want to be on that minesweeper going all that way over there. But we got them over there, some over there, and they had to go through sweeping mines and cleaning out the Persian Gulf. And then we had to fly cover for those minesweepers. It was a lot of taxpayer money spent to protect oil coming out of the Persian Gulf that we really don't need to be protecting. So I'll be there lobbying on behalf of creating jobs in this country, buying oil from Canadians versus Middle Eastern dictatorships. And then next month in June, we don't have a date yet. The chief of staff of Congresswoman Sandy Adams contacted me about getting Sandy on the show. And I gave them some dates for June, and I'll let everybody know as soon as we have a date. And I'm not sure how long she'll want to be on the show. I consider Sandy a personal friend, and I think, you know, we'll have a very nice conversation. I'm really, and I know this is not probably what everybody's interested in, but one thing I'm really, really interested in, what was it like when you first got to Washington as a freshman congresswoman, and what surprised you, what made your eyebrows go up, what didn't surprise you that ended up surprising you because it didn't surprise you, you know, all that kind of stuff. I'm just very curious about that. And then now that she's been there for almost a full term, what's really going on there? You know, what's the mood within the Republican Party, especially in the House, on what they think they can get done and where they're going to try and go in the future? So a lot of questions that we can be asking of her. Good opportunity to pick the brain of somebody who she has the distinction of being, I wouldn't say the only one, but one of a handful of of congressmen and women who has not missed a single vote, period. None. And that's rare. They always have different things going on. Her predecessor, who she replaced, was around this time frame going to fundraising events in D.C. and skipping votes. They might have just been committee votes, not big votes, but Sandy hasn't missed one single vote, period. So I think she should be commended for that, and look forward to having her on the show and picking her brain about what's going on there and what she's working on. And so that's it for announcements right now. Our friend Mark Gross is going to be coming back on the show again. We just haven't pinned down a date for that yet. And, of course, next month we start with Nick Taxia doing his special segments on our show. So we'll hand over the microphone to Nick for about 15 or 20 minutes or however much time he wants, and he'll do anything from a op-ed-type piece on something that's going on to some of his satire to even some of maybe his stand-up comedy routine that he does frequently at many of the comedy clubs in Washington, D.C. area. So we got a lot of stuff to look forward to, and it's all good. In any case, I'm going to start off with this article here, Paula, that came out yesterday, I believe, yes. And then we're going to go over to you. You've got an article on something close to home to you. How far is Newton, Massachusetts to you?
Oh, it's probably not a 15, 20-minute drive from where I am.
Okay. Well, I guess the education board there decided they would only purchase green energy. And I think the article was something along the lines of, Newton, Massachusetts goes green. Well, kind of, sort of, not really. So we'll let you fill us in on that, what's going on with that. And first off, and this was the subject of the show tonight, the accelerating corruption within the Obama administration and White House. As he gets farther down in the polls and gets more and more desperate as this election moves along, we're going to see unbelievable, not only just lying coming out of this administration, but their mouthpieces like Jay Carney. In fact, I'm going to get to the Jay Carney piece here in a few minutes after we talk about Eric Holder. But we're going to see the kind of corruption, the intimidation, and the abuses of power like never before. And here's an example, one here right now. This was written by Catherine Evans, came out in the American Thinker yesterday. Eric Holder integrates church and state in anti-voter ID pushback. Now, the liberals are always screaming, separation of church and state, separation of church and state. Can you imagine, Paula, if a Republican attorney general went to counsel white churches on voting rights, in other words, predominantly white congregations on voting rights? He's the attorney general. He's supposed to be, middle of the road, just simply enforcing the law and going to work with them and asking for their assistance. Okay, so here's another example of Eric Holder gone wild, the top law enforcement officer in the nation, joining members of the Congressional Black Caucus, IRS officials, ACLU attorneys, and clergy from the Council of National Black Churches. This is not just going out and talking to various religious organizations, specifically targeting black communities and black religious organizations. Let's see, CBC Chairman Rep. Emanuel Cleaver, the Congressional Black Caucus, he's the chairman of that, said that the summit will advise hundreds of pastors from nine different denominations on the best way to educate their parishioners on the new rules. We're talking about voter ID rules. Now, Paula, in Florida, we've had a major scandal here where we found that something like 70,000 dead people voted last year, or the last election. Yeah, they were dead, but somebody used their names to vote. Every time there's voter fraud, those of us that are legitimate voters are disenfranchised. Now, they're trying to portray it as, but poor black people can't get a voter identification card, can't register to vote. It's too complicated. They're not mobile. They can't go anywhere the way they can do that. They don't seem to care too much about poor white people not voting, but they care about poor black people. Now, they say that, well, that's the most disproportionate people, number of people that will be affected are poor black. You know, I don't see poor black people having any trouble, and for that matter, poor white people and poor Hispanics or anybody, having any trouble getting food stamps. Because I see them at the grocery store all the time using food stamps. They don't seem to have trouble getting a driver's license if they have a car.
Right.
But if they don't have a car, they don't seem to have trouble getting welfare assistance. They don't seem to have any trouble with that. Those are complicated programs. I've looked at the paperwork. It's not easy. They don't seem to have any trouble utilizing Medicare and other local, state, and county-type medical programs. They don't seem to have any trouble with that. Registering to vote is so incredibly simple. And then voting is incredibly simple. Oh, but they don't have any form of identification. How do they not have a form of identification if they can qualify for food stamps, if they can qualify for government assistance, if they go to, you want to go buy some cigarettes or some liquor? You got to show ID. Okay, let's just assume there are some poor people that don't have IDs. I know in the state of Florida, all you have to do is go to the local library and say, I need help getting a state ID. And they will help you acquire a state ID. Now, I know in some places they say, well, in some rural locations, you know, it's a long drive to get to a DMV where a photo can be snapped. And what percentage of voters does that apply to? You know, are there 70,000 voters in Florida that can't get to a DMV or someplace where they can get their photo taken and put on a state identification card? Is there? No. There are not 70,000, but there were 70,000 people dead people that voted and negated mine and 69,999 other voters.
Right.
So voter fraud is a significant problem. Okay. So, but they're trying to make this out as, and here's why. Here's why they're going all out to stop, the Attorney General is going all out to stop voter ID laws across the country, because they want people to be able to vote multiple times. They are desperate now. They want illegal immigrants to be able to vote. They're very good. Liberals are very good at getting out the vote, especially with people who aren't allowed to vote, especially with people who vote multiple times. The only voter corruption cases that have occurred in the last 10 years have all been related to Democrat organizations, Democrat-run organizations, some of them official, some of them not official party organizations, but all Democrat-run scandals. Not one Republican Party-related scandal has there been in 10 years. So, of course, I want voter ID requirements. I want people to have to show some form of identification, preferably with a photo on it, a photo ID, so that my vote doesn't get negated by somebody who shouldn't be voting, period. So that's the kind of corruption that we're going to see. A attorney general who's paid by us, the taxpayer, going out and helping his boss campaign and figuring out ways around the law. He said to Eric Holder, you know, said to them, well, we need your help in finding out and coming up with ideas for ensuring, you know, that poor black people can vote. Well, how's this for an idea? The liberals are great at providing buses and vans to get people that aren't so mobile and are poor to the voting place. Well, get them to a voter registration place now. You don't have any trouble on election day getting them to the polling places, then get them to some place where they can get a valid ID today. But no, they don't want to do that. They really don't want to do that. Because, you know, Paula, it could be somebody with a criminal record that's not allowed to vote. I mean, you know, like prison inmates.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get them to vote. Let's get them a bunch of absentee ballots and let them vote. Well, what kind of voter ID are they having to show? You know, there are ways to get around. But anyways, the thing that really sort of bothers me is when Holder refused to prosecute members of the Black Panther Party for intimidating and chasing away voters from a polling place. He took offense at being, you know, being accused of you know, racist partisanship. And he said his Department of Justice does not enforce the law in a race-conscious way, except he's going to meet with all these black clergy to work on voter ID issues. That sounds like a race-conscious way to me. And so the story ends here. Ms. Evans says, is helping black pastors to get out the vote on the taxpayer's dime not being race-conscious? And how about those pesky separation of church and state? You know, mm-hmm. if a Republican attorney general was going and working with churches, and especially a specific brand, a type of church where a particular race was prominent, oh my gosh, corruption, he'd be up before Congress on impeachment charges. Absolutely, absolutely. So it's... this is the kind of corruption we're going to see. Now, I'm going to real quickly go over Jay Carney. You've seen it on the news, but I'm going to give you my spin on this. But he was asked about, after weeks of saying that Bain Capital disqualifies Mitt Romney from being able to run for president because he was just a vampire and a leech and destroyed companies, and I'm going to get to that in just a second, but destroyed companies and, you know, it was just short-term investment. I'm going to get to that too. Was asked, let me get here, what's the difference between those investments and President Obama's failed $500 million investment in Solyndra? I'm going to read this word for word. I didn't want to play it because I can't stand listening to the guy. I just had it with the guy. He speaks terribly. But here's what he said. So you can imagine his voice, but you're going to hear my much nicer voice. Look, there is the difference in that your overall view of what your responsibilities. Am I making any sense yet?
No.
Wait, it gets better. Your responsibilities are as president and what your view of the economic future is. And the president believes, as he's made clear, that a president's responsibility is not just to those who win, but those who, for example, in a company where there have been layoffs or a company that has gone bankrupt, that we have to make sure that those folks have means to find other employment, that they have the ability to train for other kinds of work. And that's part of the overall responsibility a president has. Now, the first thing I want to say is I couldn't find that responsibility or enumerated power listed anywhere in the Constitution, Paula. The president doesn't have that responsibility. He doesn't at all. He, as a good leader and politician and human being, may take it upon himself to try and work on these issues, but that's not his responsibility in any way whatsoever. It's not written down anywhere. There's no law that says the president will do this stuff. In fact, I don't want the president doing this stuff because it's not his business. Quite frankly, it's the business of state governments to be handling these things. But so what he's really saying here, I know he's not really saying anything, but I'm going to try and interpret what I think he's trying to say, and I think I'm correct on this, is that Mitt Romney had a duty to the investors of the company he was running. And this is how it works. Investors come and say, hey, Mitt, there are some companies out there that are failing, and they're just going to go away, period, unless somebody comes in and helps them that is experienced and can turn them around. We're willing to invest in some of those companies because we believe that you have the skills and the proven ability to turn companies around. And when these companies turn around, they become more profitable. That's how we get our return on investment plus, you know, our investment plus a return.
This is true.
So two things happen. Mitt Romney helps save jobs and helps save a company. And it's not just the jobs at that company, but it's all the companies that do business with that company. And he also helps investors make money. But he more importantly brings in investors who have the money to help turn around a company that couldn't do it on its own. Now, of course, when they bring in money, they've got to get some stake in that company. You just walk up to a company and say, hey, I got $100 million for you. We're going to turn your company around, and then when it's all said and done, just give us our $100 million back. No, that's like going to a bank and saying, yeah, I want to put my money in your bank, but after 5 years, I just expect, you know, the same amount of money back. I'm not looking for a return on investment. I'm just looking for a safe place to put it. Oh, yeah, you know, that's not the way it works. Investment's investment. So what Carney is saying, well, the president isn't just concerned about making wise investments with whose money, who are the investors? The U.S. taxpayer, you and me, Paula. He's not
right.
just concerned with that, but he has to be concerned about layoffs and helping people find other employment and getting them trained for other work. Well, how does that work with Celinda? If he had been concerned about the taxpayer's investment, number one, he probably wouldn't have invested in it to begin with or would have done more research instead of rush it. Then there wouldn't be a bankruptcy. Then there wouldn't be layoffs. Then there wouldn't be employees needing to get trained for other work because it never would have been formed to begin with.
Right.
So what he's saying is I need to throw money around, and when it doesn't work out, then I need to spend more taxpayer money to make up for my mistake. Whereas, this is not Obama going in and saving companies like Solyndra. We're talking about the Solyndra example. That's creating a company. That's people saying, hey, give us a bunch of money, government, and we'll see if it works or not. In the case of Bain Capital, these were existing corporations that were failing, and they were going to go away. So the cartoon that we used as our promotional cartoon, both on the website, and if you're curious about the website, go to usaradionetwork.com if you're not already there listening to us. And I just lost it. I'm going to have to go back. And here we go. It's Mike Ramirez. I like his cartoons, and it really makes the point, quite honestly. You got Mitt Romney standing next to Barack Obama. He's got a Bain button that says B-A-I-N on his suit, and Obama's got B-A-N-E, like the bane of our existence. So what is it? What do the little things say about Mitt Romney in terms of being at Bain Capital? He turned a $37 million investment into $66 billion in assets. $66 billion. So he took his initial company with $37 million of investors' money and eventually had a $66 billion corporation. He had a 70% success rate. These are dying companies. I don't think there are too many heart surgeons or cancer doctors that have a 70% success rate. He created wealth. He created jobs. And here's just a partial list of some of these corporations that are highly successful today. They want to promote him as a vampire sucking the life out of companies and then just, you know, destroying them and walking away. Here's the 70% that made it. Burger King, Brookstone, Staples, Domino's, Dunkin' Donuts, Guitar Center, Burlington Coat Factory, Clear Channel Communications, Warner Music Group, The Weather Channel. They would have all been gone if it weren't for Bain. They weren't going to make it on their own. They needed somebody like Bain to come in. Now let's take a look at the other side of the cartoon where we've got Barack Obama. Adds $5 trillion to our national debt. Solyndra redistributes wealth. Labor participation at a 31-year low. 1 in 6 Americans are in poverty. Job killer. There you have it. There you have it. So to come after him for not being fit, I think Mitt Romney is more fit to lead this country out of economic problems than any president we've had in a long time, going back since I've been alive. He's more qualified when it comes to this area of turning economically distressed companies around. Our nation is an economically distressed country. And company, if you will. So he is highly qualified. What was the president's qualifications before he came in? Community agitator? Yeah, and a lecturer at Harvard University. President of the Harvard Law Review, and he never wrote one paper, not one. Because he's incompetent. He can't write on something like that. It's way over his head. I could write a law review paper much better than Obama could, and I'm not a lawyer, and I've not been to Harvard. And I guarantee you I could write some form of law review paper that I could get published if I were had the same background as Obama, and yet he didn't do one. Oh, he didn't. He was too busy out community agitating. So Mitt Romney is highly qualified. Now they're having to slide away from that because everybody sees right through that. Now they're saying, well, as governor, he was a failure. Well, he lowered unemployment in Massachusetts, and this president has been incapable of doing that. So, yeah, you want to keep using that one? They keep using situations or items about Romney that just keep backfiring in their face. Like we talked about the other day, the exploding cigar. Every time Obama lights up a cigar thinking, yeah, we're going to get him on this, it explodes in his face.
Right.
So I love it. I'm going to send him a box of exploding cigars. Now, that would actually get me in trouble. So I'd love to send him a box of exploding cigars. But he's doing just a fine enough job of his own, rolling his own exploding cigars.
Mm-hmm.
So there we have some of the latest in the news, just absolute incompetence coming out of this administration. And, of course, if you can find, you can find all this stuff on Facebook, the kind of things that we put out there. We try and put something reasonable out there on a weekly basis or daily basis when I'm around that much to lighten the day up and give you a little bit of humor on the situation. Now, Paula, maybe there's a little humor in the situation that so that was my spin on Jay Carney and what he's talking about. He doesn't make much sense, but he's trying to say that the president has other responsibilities when, in fact, he doesn't have any of those responsibilities whatsoever. And I really, quite honestly, don't want him going out and trying to pick winners and losers to basically make himself look better. I've got an article we'll talk about the kinds of stuff that he does in his administration to politically make himself look better, not in the interest of our taxpayers, our economy, or our nation. And we'll get to that a little bit later. But let's talk about the company or the school board, I guess it is, and you'll fill us in, that decided to go green and didn't really quite go so green. Take it away.
Well, a recent press release from Massachusetts Governor Patrick's office joined the unanimous praise for the city of Newton, which is a suburb of Boston with a population of 84,000 people. Last week, Mayor Warren signed a contract requiring 100% of municipal and school department electricity needs equal to 70 million kilowatt hours over the next 3 years. To come from renewable sources starting on the 1st of July, 2012. The initiative will save the city over $300,000 over the next 3 years. Newton's decision to power 100% of its electricity needs with green and renewable power provides a model for other Massachusetts communities to emulate, which would be another feather in Newton's cap. Going green and saving $300,000. Who could oppose a win-win deal like this? Well, a little research reveals, however, that the story is inaccurate on two essential parts. First of all, the headlines make it appear that Newton saved money because their green energy was cheaper. And this clearly does not pass the smell test. Even environmentalists admit that the cost of renewable energy is higher than that of coal and natural gas, although they might argue that it's worth spending a few pennies to save the planet. Green electricity costs more than a few pennies. As reported in a recent American Thinker article, residential consumers here in the Commonwealth who elect the NSTAR green option, which is 100% of their electricity from renewable sources, pay an 87% premium of 6.4 cents per kilowatt hour on top of the 7.9 cent kilowatt hour base rate. Under this plan, Newton's 70 million kilowatts ought to entail a $1.27 million annual surcharge on top of the base rate of $1.6 million. This is a far cry from saving $100,000 a year. Newton officials indicate that they got a good deal because they negotiated with power companies through a reverse auction, and as is the case for all large customers, prices are lower when you buy in bulk. It was revealed in a little reported statement from Newton's chief financial officer that the green prices were actually $150,000 higher than brown electricity. Newton's claims of $300,000 in savings could have been announced as an additional cost of $50,000 per year. On top of that, Newton's price savings amount to 3.33% on their $3 million electric bill. But since the price of natural gas is half of what it was a year ago,
everyone is saving money on electric bills. Massachusetts utilities NSTAR and National Grid recently announced that they were voluntarily cutting electricity rates by 16%. The green option premium was recently raised in March, and no announcement was made that it would be cut. Newton reports that it negotiated a rate of 6.6 cents a kilowatt hour with Reliant Energy, which is a Texas energy company. It's hard to reconcile this with NSTAR's 14.3 cent green rate. And if you do the math, Newton reports using 23.3 million kilowatt hours per year for a cost of roughly $3 million, which works out to 12.9 cents a kilowatt hour. It turns out that according to CFO Lemieux, about half of the $3 million, or $1.5 million, is for generating electricity. The electric bills are divided into two equal charges, generating electricity and delivering electricity. Newton, therefore, has reported a kilowatt-hour rate that reflects only the generation charges, sort of like quoting a house price and neglecting to mention that you have to pay for the land as well. A more accurate rate would be to double the 6.6 cents to 13.2 cents. Subtracting the lower rate for streetlight usage brings it to the neighborhood of the 12.9 cent estimate. A second inaccuracy in the story is it's not clear that Newton's electricity is really that green. Lemieux is quoted in the Newton tab saying, "Newton's energy will come from 100% wind power." Even if this were true, wind power only generates 2.3% of the nation's electricity. This is dated back to 2010. Converting to wind power is hardly a model that every community can emulate. Furthermore, the electrons supplied to Newton will not come from an actual wind farm. The Newton tab reports that Texas company Reliant Energy, who is the supplier, will purchase RECs, or renewable energy credits. And by the way, Reliant was indicted on criminal charges in a 2000 California brownout fiasco along with Enron, which was among George W. Bush's biggest campaign contributors. How things change when you cloak yourself in green. New England itself produces almost no green energy, and in fact, the story dominating the front pages last week was the ruling of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, responding to noise complaints ordering windmills to shut down. Reliant has to work out an exchange on paper with a wind farm in Texas. Their website clearly states that they do not purchase RECs. Rather, they use carbon offsets, which support a variety of projects that are certified to keep greenhouse gases from entering the atmosphere. Projects include sustainable forestry and methane capture at landfills and livestock biogas, which captures cow flatulence. Reliant's green energy contract also includes a donation to worthy organizations through their EcoShare program. They partner with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Foundation, the Children's Environmental Health Institute, and the Galveston Bay Foundation. These may be worthwhile events, but we've gone a long way from the 100% wind power claim. According to Reliant, it's all very scientific. They purchase and retire the carbon offsets approved by respected certification agencies such as the Climate Action Reserve. The emissions reductions are quantified by scientifically sound best practices. But if you look at the Climate Action Reserve site, a disturbing number of entries reads something like this. The Climate Action Reserve has determined that until standardized guidance for accounting of optional carbon pools is developed, we are unable to give credit for preserving or enhancing any optional carbon pool as part of any forest carbon project. So much for planting trees. The Reserve has decided to cease development of the Cropland Management Project Protocol and instead explore the feasibility of developing a protocol related to preserving or enhancing soil carbon in grasslands. To sum it up, Newton has locked in a rate for 3 years that's twice what's being paid as a residential customer, levying a hidden tax through the electric bill to purchase cow gases and to find a middle school hip to have it program. No doubt that other cities will seek to emulate Newton, Massachusetts, so that they too can be showered with green accolades. Let the buyer beware. I thought that was a really good piece.
Yeah, and it highlights some of the deception. Oh, we're going to save $300 million. It's sort of like, you know, the wife that says to her husband, I'm going out to buy a $20 dress, comes home and has a $50 dress. And the husband says, what's with the – you said you were going to buy a $20 dress.
And the shoes.
Dress,
don't forget the shoes.
Yeah, I'm trying to keep it simple for the guys out there. But he says, well, why did you buy a $50 dress? You said you were going to buy a $20 dress that you really liked. Well, this was originally a $100 dress. So I saved you $50. If I had bought the $20 dress, I wasn't going to save you any money. But I just saved you $50 by buying the $50 dress.
Right.
That's the logic they're using here. We saved $300 by bundling all the energy together and making it all green. We saved money. But compared to what we could have just bought from the normal electric company, we actually spent more money of the taxpayers' money. So if that makes people in Newton feel good and they want to do that, you know what? Go for it. You go for it, because you're definitely saving the planet. It's making a big difference. You know, I'm all for green energy if it actually pays off. But so then the carbon credit thing suddenly makes everything green. In other words, it's sort of like polluting in one lake, but then you know, keeping another lake real nice and clean. And that
right.
sort of balances out. You know, we're not polluting in both lakes, we're just polluting in one. I mean, the whole carbon offset thing, I think, is an absolute joke and a scam, and it is. But let me give you I did a little research on the wind farms in Curacao. And I didn't know why, and I discovered kind of why here, but everywhere you go online touts these wind farms. Oh, it's just great. Oh, it's doing such a great job. It's you know, they're saving money and generating electricity and reducing greenhouse gases. Paul, every time I fly into Curacao, the windmills there on the north side, as I'm coming in toward the airport on the north side of the island, right along the coast, they're never turning.
Right.
Never turning. And I couldn't find any article. All I find are these articles saying, oh, this is great, except it's not operating. Then I found somebody who made a comment. Said the wind turbines were installed about 15 years ago and since then have been damaged due to Curacao's windy and salty environment. And I'll tell you what. I land on the runway to the northeast and then taxi off and then back the other direction towards the terminal. And it looks like a dust storm, a sandstorm almost. It's the sea spray coming across that portion of the island, and sea spray is very, very damaging. So this is what this gentleman had to say back about 2 years ago. He said, and were not maintained by the previous owners. Since they are not operating efficiently anymore, they will be completely replaced with new top-of-the-line turbines that can withstand this type of climate. So, in other words, a lot of money was spent, and then it didn't hold up. Now they have some that supposedly will work. I'll be interested to see if they put them in, but it's a lot of money. And I don't know what – you probably know more about this than me – how long it's going to take for them to recoup their investment into a new set of windmills. It says a company on the island has purchased both wind – there's two wind farms. There's one on the other side. And we'll do the renovations and operate the new wind farms. Now, this was posted in January 29th, 2010. So this is, you know, 2.5 years later. And they're still sitting there. Nothing has changed. Kind of leads me to believe that it's expensive, or they would have done it by now.
What's expensive?
How long does it take? I'm trying to remember how many. Just, you know, I never counted them, but I seem to recall seeing about
money back. It's like 15 to 20 years before you see anything. 10
okay.
15 years. It depends.
Okay. Well, there were, and don't you need? You know, is more better? And say, let's say you just put one in. Let's say you put 100 in, would that recoup your investment quicker?
I don't believe so, no. I'm not that well versed on it. I'm still learning about it, believe it or not. But I'm sure the more that you put in, you know, the quicker the quicker it'll come back. But it costs more.
Yeah, they're going to have to. I mean, I could have told them that back then. You know, how long are these things going to last, these big metal structures? Even if they're aluminum, sea spray and salt is very damaging to anything. One of the biggest problems down here in Florida is that people that live right on the beach, you know, they're replacing their air conditioning units every 5-8 years, whereas, you know, even though it's humid where my house is and I'm actually sitting on a lake, you know, we're looking at 15, maybe 20 years to replace an outside air conditioning unit versus the folks at the beach are doing it every 5 to 8 years because it just destroys it. You know, anything that's metal frames around, you know, they design homes now to not have metal frames around the windows and other things because of the sea spray. And so I can understand that being a problem. And so I don't know what the technology is. The guy who, you know, mentioned it said, oh, you know, we're with new turbines that are more efficient and can replace it. The turbines that are there now, there's probably about 6 to 8 turbines on the north side there, and not a single one of them is turning. And now we know why, because they've rusted out and they don't really work anymore. So that's too bad, you know, that they invest in something like that, but they don't really plan far enough on down the future. So it looks like when the guy said they were put in 15 years ago, that was 2 years ago. Who knows how long they lasted before they didn't make it. So they lasted maybe 15 years. And you said, how long would it take to recoup your investment?
Oh, anywhere between 10 to 20, 25 years. It depends.
So they might have just recouped their investment and started getting some payback, and then all of a sudden they noticed we're not getting as much electricity out of these and found out they weren't turning as efficiently. And so they really basically barely got their investment back but never got ahead, which is too bad. So, interesting article about how government officials want to take credit for something that really doesn't quite exist, and they slant it in a way that's deceptive. And they're actually costing their taxpayers money. Now, one question I did have for you is, where does Barney Frank live?
Newton.
Well, my goodness gracious. Well, that would tell me the kind of people that live there like that kind of stuff. They, you know, like Barney Frank for so many years, then they like being screwed.
That's just wrong.
Yeah, okay. all right, we'll leave that one. So let me see what else I got here. I got other stuff, but we'll do one more thing here, and then we'll call it a night. I find this disturbing, and we got two more, and I got to get to them quickly. So here we go. Why would Obama's campaign strategist be attending the Obama kill list meetings? You've heard about the kill list meetings, where the president is given. This is according to Ed Lasky in an article he wrote just again yesterday. Let's see. I got a quote here. This was out of the New York Times. And right out of the New York Times, it says that he has
meetings.
Yeah, his Terror Tuesday meetings. And insists on approving every new name on an expanding kill list. In other words, a list that the president says, okay, go kill him. The president, judge, jury, and executioner now on terrorists. But remember, he did say that we're going to prosecute and go after terrorists in the way that American values stand for. Because George Bush, you know, using enhanced interrogation techniques, that was not the that didn't represent American values. But killing them, assassinating them, suddenly that does represent. So putting a diaper on their head or underwear on their head, that's not an American value. But killing them, that's an American value. Now, I've got to tell you this. Enhanced interrogation techniques cannot possibly be torture. Because when I went through SEER school, which stands for Survival, Evasion, Rescue, and Escape school, and aviators have to all go through that in the Air Force and the Navy so that if you get shot down or crash somewhere or whatever, that you know what to do in a survival environment. And eventually we all got captured and got to go through enhanced interrogation techniques just like they were using on our terror suspects. Everything you can think of that was used on those terrorist suspects, they used on us, including waterboarding. Now, they didn't waterboard all of us, and you know, thank goodness I didn't get waterboarded, but since this has become such a big deal, I kind of wish I had so I could tell you what it was really like. But we already know. We've heard people talk about it. But we are not allowed to torture, even in a training environment, our military service members. Not allowed to. Illegal. Can't do it. So if enhanced interrogation techniques have been used for 50 years on our service members, they could not possibly have been torture because the military is not allowed to torture its own people. But now suddenly it's torture if you do it to a mass murderer. Baloney. The legal precedent had been set for 50 years with our military that enhanced interrogation, and they're still doing it. They may not be waterboarding anymore. That's something we don't know. But enhanced interrogation techniques are still being used on our military personnel. Now, somebody would say, well, they signed up for the military, so they've agreed to that stuff. True. But it's illegal to torture our military service members. So, again, the legal precedent stands. It's not torture. Okay. So, with that said, this is straight out of the New York Times, that Tuesday terror meetings on approving, he insists on approving each and every name on an expanding kill list, poring over terrorist suspects' biographies in what one official calls a macabre of baseball cards of an unconventional war. In other words, he's got photos and bios of all the people that we might want to go kill. And he reads over them and studies them. And then he says, that one, and that one, kill them if you get the opportunity. Now, the White House will say, well, it's capture too. What terrorists have we captured lately? We're not capturing anybody. We're using drones to kill them. Drones don't capture anybody. Drones kill. So the main thing out of this is the big picture. We've got a resurgent, angry Russia, an expansionist-minded China, and a nuclearizing Iran. They get a pass. Oh, we're not going to focus on that. But we're going to focus on killing potential terrorists. Just going around and killing them. I don't have a problem with killing them, but I find it extremely hypocritical. But now here's where it starts to get dicey. David Axelrod is his senior advisor and, you know, political advisor and campaign advisor. Why is he at these high-level national security meetings? If this is all based on trying to protect America, why is he there? He's a political strategist and a campaign advisor. Senior campaign advisor. Why is a campaigner at these? Because he's looking at, just like Obama is, who it is needs to be taken out in terms of politics. What's going to make the president look the best? Let's kill the right people to make him look better. Other people we better not kill, whether it's for the good of the nation or not, because it might not make him look good if it doesn't go well. So right. Politics are playing in to this kill list, and I find this very, very disturbing. Not only does Obama seem to rely on too few people, pretty much just himself on this kind of stuff, but he's using the wrong people, not experts on national security, but a political campaign advisor. Okay, an article here from we did a bunch of American Thinker stuff here tonight, but there were some good articles in the last few days. Darren Jonescu, Obama's sons, they are real for him. I'm going to distill this down for you. You need to go look at it, but it gives you some insight into the mind, potentially, of this president, and he refers to him as the cipher-in-chief. In other words, we still don't know who this guy is. You know, he conveniently used a literary biography for 16 years that said he was born in Kenya because, obviously, it might help sell more books. Then he decides he's going to run for president. Oh, I can't be born in Kenya. I got to go back to being born in Hawaii. I don't believe that he was born in Kenya. I believe he was born in Hawaii. But I do believe he has no compulsion against lying about anything to get ahead. That's the real point. This is not a birther issue. This is simply he's willing to lie about anything in life to get ahead. Remember what Reverend Wright said to him about that meeting he had with Obama trying to get him to stop talking until the campaign was over. And Obama at the end said, you know what your problem is? You have to tell the truth, meaning he's a man of the cloth, man of God, and he, you know, has to tell the truth. In other words, but Obama doesn't, or a politician or some, you know, political ally can lie about stuff in order to further their goals, because it's really not about what's right and what's wrong and what's moral and correct. It's really about the end game. The end justifies the means. But in this article, we see that we saw recently that twice Obama referred to his daughters and his sons. It was a skip up, but he didn't blink, and he did it the second time. Same thing. He's reading off of the teleprompter. And you know, he's a good reader. We know that Obama's a very good reader, as long as the teleprompter says the right thing. He read it. It was written down. He didn't make a mistake. He read what was specifically intended. So why would he talk about something like this? And, you know, he's made other gaffes about 57 states. And, well, you know, he didn't really grow up in the states. He might have been born in Hawaii, but he went to school in Indonesia and on and on. Anyway, one of the paragraphs that I like out of this article, again by Darren Jonescu, you can go to American Thinker, it was on May 28th, said he wants his daughters to have some the same economic opportunities as his sons. He wants to be born in Kenya when it's more advantageous than being born in Hawaii. He wants to give detailed, intimate descriptions of composite girlfriends who never actually existed in concrete reality. He wants to be a Harvard intellectual among middle-class voters, a cokehead seeker of his African identity among black voters, and anti-American lefties. So it all just depends on who he's talking to. Yeah, I was a cokehead. I was a pothead. Oh, no, I'm a Harvard intellectual. Oh, I was born in Hawaii. Oh, I was born in Kenya. I mean, it just always changes depending on who he's talking to. This guy is a chameleon and quite frankly, a liar. And if he wants all these contradictory things, why can't he have them all over? I mean, after all, he is presumably Barack Hussein Obama. Let's get down to what this really, really boils down to. And this is, I think, a good psychological sort of analysis into potentially who this president is. He envisions himself as more than a man, not a god, not exactly, but a kind of ethereal roving force, a collective or collectivist energy enveloping the world. The historical majestic plural, colloquially known as the royal we, is the manner whereby those perceived as ruling by divine dispensation refer to themselves. When such a man, like a king, for example, says we, he represents himself as the symbol of the entire kingdom. Now, I'm just going to take an aside here and say, politicians, watch politicians talk, especially when they're campaigning. It's us, we, us, us. They are not supposed to say the word I. And yet this president says the word I all the time. Let's go back and look at specifically what he said in this in one of these speeches. I want women to control their own health choices, just like I want my daughters to have the same economic opportunities as my sons. We're not turning back the clock. Well, he finally said the word we in there. But he's always I, me, me, my. Just pay attention the next time you see Mitt Romney or another politician talking. It's we. It's us. We're working together. He doesn't care about us anymore. He only cares about himself. I've never, Paula, ever seen a politician use the word I as much as him, let alone in just one sentence, one paragraph. I mean, it's just, it's unbelievable. And so it's all about him. Well, why would that be? So let's take a look at a little bit more of Darren's assessment here, and that is perhaps in seeking the explanation for this inexplicable, quote, gaffe, but he read it right off the teleprompter, we're focusing on the wrong words. Perhaps the relevant question is not what he meant when he spoke of my sons, but rather when he spoke of his daughters. In other words, maybe he wasn't talking about his biological daughters. He's just talking about daughters out there in general. Isn't it more likely that he meant both sons and daughters in the same sense that he meant Kenya in his literary biography, in the same sense that he meant Muslim faith when he was talking to George Stephanopoulos, in the same sense that he meant Bill Ayers was just merely a guy in the neighborhood, and in the same sense that he means a myriad of other mind-boggling, peculiar things that he's wont to say. In short, isn't it likely that he meant no sons or daughters in particular, but all sons and daughters in general? Isn't it likely that where you or I, speaking of society as a whole, would say our daughters, our sons, Obama the Great, through his megalomaniacal, megalomaniacal, thank you, oh gosh, because I know the word, I've known it since I was a kid, megalomaniac, not because I'm one, because I understood what they were. Say it for me, Paula. Megalomaniacal, there we go. I like just that he's a megalomaniac. Reversal of the royal we speaks of my daughters and my sons. He's not all of us in a monarchical fashion. Rather, we, by which I mean all things known in the universe, are all him. See what I'm getting at here? While where other politicians and leaders talk about us and our children and our daughters and our sons, he's not representing us in his speech. We're representing him. He is everything. He is the Alpha and the Omega. He's everything in his mind. You know, so when Hegel said that the world and spirit, he is the world and the world spirit and end of the history, people thought he was nuts, but, you know, he was a great intellect. And his defense against it was, well, according to my reasoning, somebody has to embody the end of history. Why not me? Okay, if you want to think of it that way, it's still a little bit nutty. But Barack Obama, on the other hand, is an intellectual, moral, and historical lightweight, a manufactured man of significant accomplishments on paper, which somehow don't match up with anything one can point to in reality. If his delusional understanding of his relationship to the world were true, and we were all him, the world would be in a heap of trouble. So regardless of what his personality disorder really is, I've never seen anybody talk in this manner about I, me, and then for him to specifically say with intent, my sons. I think this. I think Darren is onto something here, that he is deluded into thinking that instead of him representing us, we represent him now in a very distorted and twisted way. I find it very disturbing. So Obama's sons, they're real for him or not, but nobody really believes that he has some real sons and that I don't believe he made a gaffe. I don't believe he made a mistake. I don't know. What do you think, Paula?
That one would be difficult for me to comment on, unfortunately.
That's okay. Well, I think he's got some serious personality disorders.
Obama?
Yeah, I know. Hard to believe, huh?
Why would you think he would have a personality disorder?
Well, you know, when I can't remember who wrote the article. It came out MSNBC or some other particular paper magazine, but that said that, oh, well, if you look at the rate at which the debt has grown under this president, that it's gone up at a very, very low rate. Yeah, $1.3 trillion deficits every year. It stays the same. You know, it's like this, Paula. Let's say that I get elected to some office next year. It doesn't really matter whether it's elected. Let's say I join a gym. In the first year that I'm at that gym, I gain 50 pounds. The next year, I gain another 50 pounds. And the third year, I gain another 50 pounds. And the fourth year, I'm on track to gain another 50 pounds, 200 pounds in total. And somebody says, Tom, you joined a gym, but you just keep gaining weight. And I say to them, instead of saying, well, my weight has stayed the same, knowing that my weight has gone up 50 pounds every year, I could say the rate at which my weight has been going up has been rock steady. It has not changed in 4 years. That's what he's saying. He's saying the rate at which the debt has been increasing is the same. It's increasing at an astronomical rate, but it's increasing at the same rate, the same percentage, the same amount that it has since he took over. For example, we'll keep doing some for examples here. All of the debt that every administration, every government had accumulated since 1776 we have to go back to 1780s when we actually had the Constitution that we have now. But what was I getting? Okay, all of the debt that's been accumulated in the history of our nation, when he took over, was $10 trillion. When he leaves office, it'll be $16 trillion. So he's accumulated $6 trillion in just 4 years. It took over 235 years to accumulate $10 trillion and just 4 years to accumulate $6 trillion. But he says he's not a spender. He hasn't presided over massive debt. It's an outright lie. He is a liar. That is a lie. He is correct that the debt hasn't really changed much, and this is why the Senate does not pass a budget, because – if you do a continuing resolution, what is the continuing resolution of? It's the continuing resolution of 2009, when we had a very large deficit, which you add upon a stimulus package and, you know, government bailouts for banks and auto industry, et cetera. You're just continuing that spending. That was not normal budget. So that's why they don't, Paula, want to do a budget, because they would have to go back to a normal baseline. They want to keep this massive, massive debt baseline going, so they will not, I guarantee you, they will not pass a budget. They like spending all this money and going much further into debt at a much higher rate. So the real question that needs to be asked of the Obama administration is, why have you not only continued the Bush-era spending binge, why have you tripled down on it? Now he doesn't have anything to say. The one thing they're going to try and say is, oh, but his budget, the 2009 budget, wasn't his. It was George Bush's. It's true. It started under the Bush administration. But guess what? Do you know when that bill was signed, Paula, that actual bill? Nancy Pelosi did not have a bill ready to be signed until 2 months after Barack Obama took office. The signature on the 2009 budget is Barack Obama, not George Bush. at the time, Obama said, well, this was, you know, originally the Bush budget. I'm going to sign it for him, but it's not mine. He tried to make it clear. It's not my budget, but I'm going to sign it because I'm the president here. He didn't have to sign it. You know, he was doing George Bush a favor. Okay, I'll tell you what. If you want to count the stimulus as part of the George Bush 2009 budget debt, then guess what? We have to start giving credit for the stimulus to George Bush. They're always taking credit for the stimulus, right? Even though it didn't do anything. They're always taking credit for the stimulus. Wait, it turns out it's actually George Bush's credit. This is another thing that this administration does, is it likes to steal credit where it has done absolutely nothing to its name. Now, in this case, they're lying about the fact that it was George Bush's budget. It was not. The budget that George Bush was reviewing and looking over that finally came back and would have come back to him via Nancy Pelosi had an additional $490 billion of spending in it that wasn't there when George Bush was still president. It's an outright lie to say that it's George Bush's budget. It's Barack Obama's budget. He signed it. It's his, period. So, you know, pathological liar, pathological megalomaniac, on and on. We need somebody
finally got it right.
We just need somebody that's not quite such a nut job, really. We need somebody that actually is down to earth and in touch with reality. And people say, well, Mitt Romney's not in touch with reality. He's a rich guy.
Well, you know what? However he came into his riches, he came into them, and I say good for him. Anybody that does what he did, that's their business. At least he turned something around. Like I said, when he left the Commonwealth, he left us with a 4.3% unemployment rate. Where are we now? We're in double digits right now.
Right. Well, you know, and the other thing is that John Kerry, nobody in the media had a problem with him being rich when he ran for president. Nobody. They never said, oh, he's unsuitable. He's not in touch with the average American, you know, and Teddy Kennedy and all of the Kennedy clan. All, you know, some of them have never worked. Some of them have never, ever worked. They come from a wealthy family. But they're all suitable.
Our unemployment rate is now at 7%. I apologize. I thought it was double digits, but.
Oh, okay.
Somebody must have fudged the number while I wasn't looking.
It's bad enough. Well, that's bad enough. All right, Paula, well, I think we've covered all of the important stuff and stuff that maybe people aren't going to get from the mainstream media. Let's wrap it up with your tribute to our troops.
Continuing our series with honoring the fallen, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have claimed the lives of more than 450 Americans, bringing the U.S. death toll to more than 6,300 since 2001. Five names I'll be reading from the list this evening: James Kevin Crawford, 50, Zaina K. Kramer, 28, William Harry Krause IV, 22, Dominique Dion Cruz, 26, and Ari Richard Cullors, 28. From the Military Times website, recently on May the 28th, Army Captain John R. Brainerd had lost his life on May the 28th, serving during Operation Enduring Freedom. He was from Dover Foxcroft, Maine, and he was assigned to the 12th Combat Aviation Brigade, Ansbach, Katterbach, Germany. Wounds sustained when his AH-64 Apache helicopter crashed. Also killed was Army Chief Warrant Officer 5 John C. Pratt. John C. Pratt had lost his life on the same day. He was 51 from Springfield, Virginia. He was assigned to the 12th Combat Aviation Brigade, and it was in the same helicopter with Army Captain John R. Brainerd. On May the 27th of this year, Army Specialist Tofiga J. Totolo, 23, serving during Operation Enduring Freedom, of Wilmington, California, he was assigned to the 3rd Squadron, 61st Cavalry Regiment, 4th Brigade Combat Team, 4th Infantry Division, Fort Carson, Colorado. He lost his life in Vati Khat, Nangarhar Province, Afghanistan, of wounds caused by an enemy improvised explosive device. As well, on May the 26th, 21-year-old Army Specialist Vilmar Galarza Hernandez of Salinas, California, was assigned to the 4th Battalion, 23rd Infantry Regiment, 2nd Striker Brigade Combat Team, 2nd Infantry Division, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, Washington, in Afghanistan as well, of wounds caused by an improvised explosive device. Today is the 31st, recently celebrating our Memorial Day weekend, our long weekend. I hope that everyone did enjoy their long three-day weekend, but also remembered why they were celebrating that three-day weekend. It was because of your veterans. It was because of the individuals that leave home, that leave their mothers, their fathers, their brothers, their sisters, their wives and their husbands and their children to go overseas to fight for the freedoms and liberties of this country and of the countrymen that they're serving overseas, specifically to the Army Battalion. Your families love and miss you dearly. We pray for you each evening, and we, you know, hope that you come back to us real soon.
All right, Paula, thank you so much. Well, our next show will be next week, the 7th of July, and we'll have our kickoff of the very first ever Nicktaxia segment. I expect he'll take 10 or 15 minutes, so you don't want to miss that. Thanks for being with us tonight, Paula. You have a great rest of the week and weekend, and we'll see you back next week. All right. Take care. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week, July 7th.
Listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.